Checkerfin.
Fordham is always in my head.
Checkerfin. Checkerfin.
Yes.
It's the education gadfly
sex,
show.
Sex.
Mike and Rick tell you
early college, high school, pain and suffering,
in your face, in your face,
your
face.
Listen to your word that they be preaching, cause here's the education gadfly show. Yeah. It's the education gadfly.
Hello, this is your host Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation. Here with my co-host, a man who put out a book that's like all brand, Rick Hess.
Hey, how you doing, Mikey?
I'm good, Rick. I should explain what that means here. You know, in this week's Education Gadfly, Kobe Loop writes a review of your latest book. And guess what he says?
What's he say?
It's like all brand.
What's that mean?
It's kind of boring, but it's good for you. Was I not supposed to say that?
That's probably not unfair. I think it's frequently been said that Fordham is like sugar corn pops or Fruit Loops.
Oh!
Fun, and it tastes good, and, you know, it's fortified with some vitamins and minerals. But when you really need to get your fiber, you got to go AEI, baby.
Well, of course, we were talking about your research and education book, The Politics of Research, and I have to say, Mr. Pop-Tart here, Pop-Tart Petrilli, has a chapter in it. So what is that? Is that fiber? Is that not fiber? What are you talking about here?
That's the thing, baby. You're capable of fiber. Mm-hmm. And you did a nice job with it. I think it has been widely regarded as a really important piece.
Well, that's
nice. You could have been a scholar.
Because I kind of fell asleep in the middle of writing it. I was so
you could have been a scholar. You got distracted by punditry.
But speaking of exciting policy analysis that is actually going to be read by a wide audience, Rick, you and Kobe have a new report out this week, Leadership Limbo.
We do. Actually, I guess it just got released this morning, didn't it?
That's right. That's right. So tell our audience just a little bit about it. This is about collective bargaining agreements and other assorted policies in non-collective bargaining states, the 50 largest school districts. What did you find?
Wow, you just made that sound tedious as all hell, didn't you?
I did.
What we did was we studied the collective bargaining agreements in the nation's 50 biggest districts, and we found a couple things. I think almost all of them are interesting in some extent. One, that as the critics have suggested, in a pretty decent number of districts, the contracts just make it almost impossible to understand how somebody could manage effectively.
Right.
A third of the districts.
Right, about 15 of the 50, which, by the way, are big districts with lots of minority students. Well, we estimate around 10% of the nation's African-American students in those districts.
Yeah, and so that's, in those districts in particular, the conventional critiques of contracts really hit home, that these things make it hard for principals or superintendents to evaluate teachers, to base personnel decisions on individual quality, to adjust compensation in sensible ways, and so forth. Similarly, there's only a tiny handful of districts, five districts nationwide out of the 50 biggest, that are even modestly flexible. And the top-rated guy there is Guilford County, North Carolina. But there's just five out of the 50. But perhaps the most interesting finding is that the majority of districts, about 60% of them, it's not obvious that they're inflexible. Their contracts are actually either kind of silent on a lot of the key stuff, or they're a little bit ambiguous. And it's clearly the case that even so, principals and superintendents are not taking, action to try to be more creative about attracting good personnel, about using compensation to attract and recruit talent, about transferring teachers to where they're needed most, about evaluating teachers aggressively. They're simply not using the authority they currently have. Mm-hmm. And what's happened there, I think, is that the contracts and even the unions have been getting blamed for things which aren't really their fault so much as it is management's fault.
Mm-hmm.
Why exactly this is it because they're cautious, because management doesn't know what to do, because they're scared of union power? These are big questions. But they're not questions which we can simply ignore and blame the contracts in those districts.
All right. Well, in typical Rick Hess style, careful analysis, and you're going to find a way to make everybody angry, both the unions and the district leadership.
It's what we do best, baby.
Okay, good. Well, people can check that out on our website at excellence.net. We got a lot to cover today, so let's get started. Christina, kick us off with Pardon the Gadfly.
Topic one. In Florida, teachers who have been fired are being reinstated because their students scored well on the FCAT, the Sunshine State's high-stakes test. One teacher, reportedly fired in 2005 after failing to improve his lessons, will get his job back and $168,000 in back pay. Rick, what's up?
Wow. This is a little confusing to me. So why'd they fire the guy in the first place?
Okay, so here it is, Rick. You've got these teachers, all right, who were falling down on the job. All right, let's say they were, you know, their kids, students were sleeping in class. They weren't preparing for their lessons. They were just not very good teachers. And remarkably, in some Florida districts, they could actually be fired because of it. So these teachers are basically bad teachers. They've gone through the process. The principals have removed them. But then they filed a complaint saying, hey, my FCAT scores for my students weren't all that bad, and therefore I should get my job back. And some courts have agreed that, in fact, there's evidence that they were decent teachers after all because their kids were getting good test scores.
This kind of turns the whole debate on its head, doesn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. Oh, Rick, you get
I gotta
it.
I got to say, you know, for those people who want to melt this stuff down to value added in grades 3 to 8, if you're teaching grades 3 to 8 and your test scores are moving by that logic, it's these people, you know, these reformers seem to be setting themselves up for this response.
That's right. But here's the thing, Rick. I mean, let's admit that test scores should not be the sole basis for decisions about teacher evaluations or promotion or dismissal. They are only a part of they're a data point. They are
now you sound like a union apologist, because I have heard on many occasions reformers in Texas and Florida and elsewhere say, oh, it's about teaching kids the skills and the rest of the stuff's a distraction. And that, and you're exactly right, that is a mistaken analysis. That anybody, even fans of high-stakes accountability and fans of, you know, sensible use of tests like us, needs to always be aware of exactly what you're saying, or else we set ourselves up for exactly this kind of challenge.
That's right. But still, the principal, I think we should trust principal discretion here. The principal had a good case that the teacher should be fired just because they've got decent test scores, especially in places where the kids are going to do well on tests no matter what happens
exactly. In
the classroom.
But this is exactly the flip side of the problem with identifying teachers or schools as inadequate based simply and solely on poor test scores.
That's right.
That it's, you know, that the test scores are an important and really useful
okay.
data point, but not the whole ballgame.
You got to pay attention to the bell, or else we're going to terminate.
Hey, we don't have time for the bell, man. We got. There's children in need.
Okay, Christina, topic number two.
Well, even if we terminate him, he could come back to collect back pay. You never know.
That's right.
Next one, a new Maryland report argues that requiring students to stay in school until they're 18 is the way to lower dropout rates. Others complain that doing so will cost lots of money. Mike, what's wrong with this debate?
Oh, my goodness, Christina. So here it is. There's a Baltimore Sun article saying talking about how there's a proposal to raise the age until 18, saying the students are not allowed to drop out before that or else they would be considered truant, I guess. And people said, no, we can't do this because it's going to cost too much money. In other words, they have baked into their budgets the assumption that they're going to lose a whole bunch of 16 and 17-year-olds before they graduate. I mean, this is crazy. I would think taxpayers believe when they're signing the checks for a K-12 system that they're actually, you know, there's enough money there to support students from K-12. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's like we're rooting for people to drop out.
Well, but this is equally ridiculous on the other side. I mean, that's true. If we don't let people leave the building, we can absolutely reduce the dropout rate significantly.
Yeah, well,
I'm not sure what all.
Well, but this is so Rick, this is my question though. For some reason people seem to believe that just by saying that you're not allowed to leave before 18, that will change the minds of some, you know, say 17-year-olds who otherwise would have dropped out. Is there any reason to believe that's the case?
You know, I mean, that's actually a neat researchable question. I absolutely believe that's going to be true for some number of kids. I think if you set the expectation so that, you know, particularly in communities where you got high numbers of dropouts, if you really kind of change the law there and you just change the expectation, that it probably will make a difference for one kid out of 10 or one kid out of 100 or one kid out of 5, I don't know. But on the other hand, it also means that you're going to have a whole bunch of kids. One of the questions is, how are you going to enforce this? If it's the laws that the kid has to be in school and the kid's not in school, what are we prepared to do? And then second, what are we going to do with these kids in these schools who not, you know, who really, really, really don't want to be there? And is that going to create disruption and problems for teachers and other kids?
Whew, whew. I think what we should do with those kids that don't show up is hard labor, Rick.
Mm.
I mean, they're, let's face it.
I think we should do hard labor for their parents.
I mean, Baltimore is a crumbling city. We have all kinds of public work programs that could need their attention. So
I think Obama would push it, baby.
You know, Rick, ever since we started having Jeff Kuhner come on the show with his Education Outrage of the Week, I just feel myself getting outraged about this stuff. I mean, this is outrageous. Okay, Christina. Next topic.
Last one. The Los Angeles Times recommends that the city's school district run elementary schools and leave the middle and high schools for charter operators to take over. Is this as swell an idea as it sounds?
What is this? I think we've gone back to like 1992 when everybody had a fad of the week. I mean, why do we think this is an any better idea than having the district run middle schools and high schools and turn the elementaries over to charter operators?
Yes, that's going to be the editorial next week.
I mean, for instance, Kip is a, you know, I mean, I don't know. Kip's what, 5 to 8 in most of its configurations?
Yep.
And so is 5 an elementary grade or a middle school grade? I understand there's a logic here, the whole portfolio high school provision, and that you need a coherent kind of curriculum pedagogical framework, K-5 or K-6, blah, blah, blah. But still, I mean, it's just the notion that this is going to somehow make a difference just strikes me as naive and fad-driven.
So, Rick, let's be honest with ourselves. Nobody knows what to do about urban high schools. I mean, mm-hmm. I mean, what are there like 3 or 4 good urban high schools that people point to out there around the entire country? You know, and yes, some
and
of them are charter
the
schools.
Same 3 or 4.
What's that?
And it's not always the same 3 to 4.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I can the Match Charter School. I can't think of very many others. And I guess we won't have time to do so. But my point being, you know, whether it's charter or the district, I think that the bigger problem is that we just don't have any agreement in this country about what we expect high school students to be able to do and what the purpose of high school is. And until we have some greater clarity on that, I'm not sure any of the rest of this is going to matter. So that's what I have to say about that. But enough with Pardon the Gadfly. It is now time for our special feature. We introduced it to you last week. If you weren't listening, listeners, you really missed out because it was the inaugural edition of Jeff Kuhner's Education Outrage of the Week. Last week, he was outraged about an Arabic school in New York City. Jeff Kuhner, welcome back to the show. And what are you outraged about this week?
Mike, it's less the outrage of the week than the stupidity or idiocy of the week.
Wait. This is a new feature. It's only your second week.
It's outrageous. It's outrageous, but it's outrageous in its stupidity.
Okay.
USA Today had a piece last week by Greg Topo, a good piece, where he
Greg, a loyal listener of the show.
A loyal listener to the show somebody who does good work at USA Today. He had a very nice piece on a research study that had been conducted by lead was taken by Stanford University, which looked at over 2,000 students, high school juniors, high school seniors in all 50 states, very diverse group. And they asked literally one question. Name the 10 most famous, and I underline the word famous, people in American history. Well, the results were absolutely shocking and startling. Now, one thing I want to tell all the audience out there is no presidents or first ladies were allowed. So they were excluded from the study. Well, the students came up overwhelmingly with Martin Luther King Jr. Not a bad choice. But then some of the other choices, frankly, were a little bit ridiculous. Harriet Tubman. I don't know if you know who she is, Mike.
Well, yes, I know who Harriet Tubman is.
I've never heard of her. But anyway, she came in at number 2.
Wait, hold on. Jeff, you've never heard of Harriet Tubman?
I've never heard of Harriet Tubman.
I mean, I know, first of all, everyone should know that Jeff is from Canada. We should put that on.
I am originally from Canada,
okay.
Yes.
All right, but she was a famous abolitionist. She was, you know, helped on the Underground Railroad. I mean, helping slaves escape to Canada. This is an important part of Canadian history.
I'll tell you, we didn't know about her up in Canada. I don't know how she made it to number 2, but anyway.
Canadian educational system.
Jeff, that is the outrage of the week.
She's at number 2. Rosa Parks made number 3. And then you start going down the list. There's Susan B. Anthony. And then it gets more ridiculous. You have Amelia Earhart, a woman who flew a plane for the first time, first woman to fly a plane, crashed the plane. So you fly and you crash. If, you know, I guess if you're the first Armenian American to fly a plane and crash it, you'll be on some kind of top 10 list. But anyway, so she flies the plane, crashes it. Then Oprah Winfrey, number 7, Oprah Winfrey. Top 10 most famous Americans.
Can you deny that?
Marilyn Monroe.
She's incredibly famous.
Well, here's the thing, Mike. This is the problem that I have. I think that what it shows is how politicized the teaching of history has become in our K-12 curriculum. And what this list shows is the triumph of political correctness and our celebrity culture over, I just think, common sense and the proper understanding of America's past.
Okay, so who would you want to see on that list?
Well, I mean, there's some obvious. How about the person that discovered America? Christopher Columbus. What do you think? Maybe top 10? How about Alexander Hamilton? Gave us our financial system, one of the leading founding fathers. Now, I have to say, we were very happy. Ben Franklin, you know, brace yourself, he actually made the list. So not every dead white male did not make the list. A couple did actually creep in. You know, that little thing, the 1776 war, where we fought against the British. And so he was, you know, instrumental in that. So the students, I guess, felt, well, we had to owe him.
What is this about we? Hold on. Didn't you guys sit that one out?
What do you mean did we? That's the thing. We took all the loyalists. All the loyalists went up to Canada. So we ended up, we got a double whammy. Not only did we not participate in the war, we had to take in all the British loyalists, and we've been paying for it ever since, my friend. Let me just tell you that. But anyway, so, I mean, you know, Marilyn Monroe. So, I mean, look, to me, you look at the people on this list, it's really outrageous. People like Henry Ford were not mentioned. People like Douglas MacArthur were not mentioned. People like Ernest Hemingway were not mentioned. And, you know, the question that I have is, and I think genuinely this is really an outrage, we're pouring billions and tens of billions of dollars into our education system, and we are really turning out historical illiterates. You know, where people, I mean, no one's going to tell me with a straight face that Marilyn Monroe, you know, frankly, I think she was a limited actress. Frankly, if you, you know, to be brutally honest, a slut with limited talent, but let that go. I mean, I don't know who she did not sleep with. You know, the Kennedy brothers certainly passed her around pretty good. But anyway, she does a movie where her red skirt goes
up in
the air.
This is a family show.
Oh, sorry. Her red skirt goes up in the air, and suddenly she becomes like one of the 10 most famous Americans in history. Oprah Winfrey, Harriet Tubman, whatever, the Underground Railroad, everything that she did there. Oprah Winfrey, Marilyn Monroe, Harriet Tubman, Amelia Earhart, crashed the plane, would not make it for me in a top 100 list, never mind a top 10 list. And that to me is really the education outrage of the week.
Okay, Jeff Kooners, education outrage of the week. Thank you, Jeff, for coming on the show and probably offending many, many of our listeners. Wow. I never, what do you think, Liam? I had never thought of Amelia Earhart like that before.
No, not at all.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Jeff. All right, well.
Always a pleasure.
Okay, and what is also always a pleasure, something we look forward to all week long, education news of the weird. With our special correspondent, Liam Julian. Liam, what's weird this week?
There's a principal in Seminole, Florida. Okay, this is around the Tampa Bay area. He eats crickets when his students do well on standardized tests. It's true.
Liam, this new casual approach of yours. Are you trying to mimic Jeff?
No, I thought I wrote it, but I didn't. I didn't. I thought I wrote it down, but I didn't. But I know the story. Basically, the guy, the principal at this middle school, tells his kids, if you do well on your standardized tests, if you make it, you know, onto the honor roll, I will eat live crickets in the cafeteria in front of everyone. The students responded, he ate live crickets. That's it.
Wow. Okay. First of all, now, Kobe, I want to make sure that we can splice in some of the audio from. There's a video out there of this principal. Let's take a listen.
I'm Bob Vicari. I'm the principal at Osceola Middle School, and as a result of a challenge where students set a new Osceola Middle School record for honor roll principal list and E-team, something they do for behavior, The students ended up winning, and today I get to eat live crickets at each one of the three lunches. All right, guys, I have some dipping sauce for my crickets. How many people would use Italian dressing? Raise your hand if you use Italian dressing. How many people would use ketchup? Ready?
Wow. I mean, what do you think, Rick? I mean, if you had stayed in the, you know, directly in the education field as a teacher and graduated being a principal, would you have done this? Would you have eaten crickets for your students?
Not. There's no way. The larger question, though, is that I think Liam has just disproved something which we have long believed.
What's that?
The value of competition is... You know, I thought having Cooner and the other slob was going to force Liam to raise his game. And instead, we get one of the most haphazard and least impressive demonstrations in the Julian oeuvre.
Yeah, yeah. Well, see, what you have to understand, Rick, is that Liam is leaving tomorrow for Puerto Rico with his beloved. And so I think he's just his head somewhere else, you know? He's just not focused on education. He's the weird this week.
Would you accept this, Mike, if you were a principal? Would you say of your teachers, oh, geez, my teacher's going on vacation, therefore the kids don't need to learn?
That's a very good point. Well, I don't know what we're going to do about this. I don't know.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Groveling will help, yeah. But Rick, you say that you wouldn't eat crickets, but, you know, didn't you teach down in Louisiana where you used to eat crawfish all the time?
I mean, crawfish, very different.
Did you pull any stunts like that in the classroom?
No. I think I lack this kind of imagination. I like to think of this as kind of the Ozzy Osbourne school of pedagogy.
Yes. Nicely said, Rick. All right, well.
That's because he ate a bat, right?
Yeah, that's right. Thank you.
We had students in my class who literally ate their schnots.
Okay. All right. What are you doing making Jeff's microphone live? All right, Jeff comes in, he does one segment, and that's it. Okay?
Jeff. I mean, it was a bit of a scandal. I mean, the principal was very upset. Apparently, it was like an epidemic. A lot of students were like picking their nose and then eating their schnapps.
Yeah, it's not really analogous, though.
Anyways. I don't know. In Louisiana, even in Louisiana, the kids weren't allowed to have schnapps in school. Goldschlager, peppermint, what have you.
Okay.
Where were these kids scoring schnapps?
Right. And that is going to have to be all the time we have for this week. Well, thank you for listening. Until next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, signing off.